Welcome to another edition of the Middlers Podcast. This is Bill. Yusuf could not join us this evening, so I'll be taking this interview myself. I'm extremely excited to have a guest with us this evening. We have with us Deepa Iyer. Deepa is with SALT, which is an organization active in throughout the U.S., especially in the Northeast. And really, this will be an interview to give us a chance to explore what SALT does and Deepa's involvement in the community. So, Deepa, welcome to the Middlers Podcast.
Thanks so much, Bill. Happy to be here.
Great. So, Deepa, help us understand a little bit about yourself and where you're from, as well as a little bit about SALT as an organization.
Sure. Well, as my own background is concerned, I grew up in India, in South India, in Kerala, and I was born and raised there and lived there until I was about 12 years old and then moved to the United States at that time. Moved to the state of Kentucky, which was an interesting experience sort of growing up as an adolescent in the South, in the American South. And, you know, really encountered, I think, a lot of the challenges that many immigrants to this country face in terms of noticing difference, noticing discrimination, differential treatment, both in terms of the culture that I was in at school, but also in terms of experiences that my parents were facing that I noticed and observed. And I think that you know, my immigrant background had a lot to do with my eventual movement towards the work that I've been doing for about a decade now, both at SALT and outside of SALT in other arenas. But that's a little bit about myself. And in terms of the organization, we are a national nonprofit organization, and our goal is to really reflect the voices and perspectives of South Asians in this country. And we do this using a social justice framework. We focus on policy issues primarily, providing research, documentation, and advocacy around issues such as civil rights and immigration. We also engage in programs related to community mobilization, leadership development, and building partnerships both within the South Asian community and outside of it.
That's fantastic. Help us understand a little bit about what SALT stands for and mention the website as well for listeners who are interested in learning more.
Sure. Folks can learn more about SALT at www.saalt.org. And as I mentioned, we really kind of came about in 2000, in the year 2000, because there was at that time no national organization that was really looking at issues affecting the South Asian community. But our real watershed moment came after September 11th, 2001, and the unprecedented backlash that our community members began to face and report. And in that moment, we felt that we could take a leadership role in terms of advocating at the national level with government agencies, with policymakers, to make sure that they understood what the impact was of policies such as the Patriot Act or interrogations and detentions and deportations of our community members, and that we could play a role there in terms of providing information, providing documentation to policymakers, and also making sure our community members understood what their rights were during that time, in that really urgent time right after 9/11. And slowly we sort of have evolved to address issues that go beyond just the 9/11 frame, but that is an important aspect of our work in terms of really situating ourselves within a movement of folks who are facing discrimination or bias or injustice just by virtue of the fact that they're from a particular country or they practice a particular faith. And so again, our work has really been sort of moved by that moment, that 9/11 historical moment. And I would say one of the other aspects of our work that I think is unique is that we really take a lot of our work very seriously in terms of making sure that we are reflecting what's actually happening on the ground. So a lot of a lot of the work that we do in Washington actually comes to us from the eyes and ears of nonprofits that are part of a network that we coordinate. So these are local organizations located in 12 different parts of the country that are connected to each other through SALT, and we are able to understand better what's happening in our community and then reflect that to policymakers in Washington. So in many ways, we're kind of really the community's voice and the community's place at policymaking tables in Washington.
That's really helpful. You know, that when you mentioned when SALT started up, I heard 2000, and the first thing that my mind gravitated to was, wow, that was before 9/11, right? That was kind of a turning point for the U.S. in many ways, and for the world for that matter. So it occurs to me to want to dig into that. But if I may, I want to rewind a little bit before that, Deepa, that you were talking about in terms of coming from Kerala to Kentucky. I've never quite heard of that migration path. It's actually pretty fascinating. You know, when we were in India, we had a good friend who was, gosh, she was probably in her mid-30s, had returned back to India after spending, I would say, probably age 12 to age 28 or 30 in the U.S. And she went from, I think, Gujarat to rural Arkansas, where she was absolutely the only South Asian, especially during that period of time. Maybe that community's changed since, but at that time, you know, she went from one world to another immediately. And, you know, rural setting, southern setting, northern, I think that there's a lot that comes with assumptions about regional, you know, perspectives on diversity, et cetera. But I think that that's got to be a challenge regardless of where anyone comes from. Tell us a little bit about what it was like to go from, were you in Trivandrum or Cochin? Where were you in Kerala when you started?
So I was born and raised in Trivandrum, actually.
Okay. And then you went to where did you go to in Kentucky?
To Louisville. So that's kind of where we ended up, and primarily because of my dad's job that took us there. He was he had a fellowship at a university in Louisville, and that's kind of how we ended up there. But, you know, I don't know that, you know, my experience was all that unique. I think a lot of immigrant children face some of those same sorts of experiences. I think that in our situation, what made, you know, some of that unique was, first of all, sort of the paradigm when it came to race that, you know, that the South really operates in and was operating in then, which tends to often be a black and white paradigm. And so I think that it was difficult at that time, this was, you know, in the mid-80s, for folks to really understand where my family was from or, you know, other South Asians in the area, where we sort of fit in. And so I think there was a lot of that going on, a lot of questioning of from other people, and sort of this feeling that we just didn't fit into the ways that people thought about race, especially at that time in Kentucky. And then secondly, you know, there were South Asian families in the area at the time, but, you know, it was still a very small community, and so there was just definitely a sense of, you know, not like pure isolation, but a sense of, you know, it wasn't like growing up in Queens, for example, or somewhere in Jersey or California. So I think it was kind of the compounding of those two characteristics that made it a little bit more unique.
Interesting. So, okay, so you grow up in the U.S. And you arrive at the point in 2000 where you want to start up SALT. Talk a little bit about that first year, and then in 2001, what happened on 9/11 and kind of how that influenced not only your personal journey, but where SALT was headed and the circumstances that that you found yourself in.
Sure. Well, so as I mentioned, SALT had started in 2000, and I was actually asked to join the founding board after the organization had been founded. And so I did have a bit of, you know, I did work on sort of the movement of the organization in terms of how it was framed and what it was working on. But you know, as you mentioned, 9/11 was that turning point. And I think that, you know, on 9/11, I was actually working at the Department of Justice at the Civil Rights Division as an attorney there. And for me, you know, there was that experience of being absolutely devastated by what was happening on September 11th, you know, evacuated from our federal building, sort of not being able to return home for quite some time, not really knowing how to reach friends and family, and just, you know, really sharing in the horror and the devastation that everyone was feeling on that day. And shortly thereafter, that grief and that that feeling of just hopelessness was compounded by a lot of the reports that we started to hear from community members who were saying that they were being harassed, you know, Sikh men who were being chased down streets because they were wearing turbans, Muslims who were being stopped on airplanes or in airports or trains, people being called names, people being afraid of wearing religious articles of their faith. You know, so many different kinds of reports started to come about of discrimination, harassment, bullying, profiling. And where I was working at the Civil Rights Division, I had a really unique opportunity there to work with others to actually address some of this backlash discrimination by really bringing the tools of the federal government to the fore. And that was a very unique opportunity. And at the same time, I was also, as a board member of SALT, assisting the organization in really thinking about its place. What could the organization do to really speak up for community members from an advocacy standpoint and really representing what was happening in the community? And so that's my personal involvement. And then about a couple of years later, SALT was able to raise some funds and able to start up an office. And at that time, the board asked me if I would become the first executive director. So we started our office in 2004, so a good 3 years after 9/11, when we were able to really marshal the funding and the resources necessary to start up as an actual, you know, funded organization with staff. And so we've grown since then in many ways in terms of what we work on, what we do. But again, sort of that moment is still, to us, one of the watershed moments in terms of our own short organizational history and, of course, in our community.
Let me share an observation from my side as it relates to 9/11. So I remember those events, right, are very clear in everyone's memory, who, regardless of where they were, I think everyone around the world kind of stopped all at once and took note of what was happening. And I remember hearing, I think it might have been a day later, 2 days later, but I remember hearing that a group of people had beaten a Sikh man to death. And that may be the only case of that, but that is, that's that anger and rage that came. And I remember thinking, you know, this is not only dead serious and this is a horrible time, but there's got to be a lot of people who are kind of living in fear that they're being associated with, you know, mm-hmm. the attackers of 9/11. And then within a couple of years, I had a good friend, Neeraj, a colleague at the company I was working with at the time. He generally wore like a beard, nicely, you know, cut to his face, very fashionable, kind of a perpetual 5 o'clock shadow. He shaved it off one day, and I was asking him about it. He goes, "Yeah, I got a fly." I just thought, wow, you know, there's whole things that you know, non-South Asians or let's say the majority community in the U.S. wouldn't even consider. Talk a little bit about what life has been like for people of various communities, but especially South Asians and Muslims after 9/11, based on what you've seen and experienced and dealt with.
Yeah, I mean, I think sadly the sentiment that exists in this country when it comes to South Asians, Muslims, Arab Americans, Sikh Americans is not is not as positive as it could be or should be. And we're still living in this climate where there is this anti-Muslim sentiment, there is Islamophobia, there is this sense that South Asian and Arab American men especially are suspects or disloyal. And, you know, I think that story that you recount about your friend, you know, having to change something about his appearance because he needs to travel, you know, it really resonates with me because these are, that, you know, these are stories that we hear all the time, and they range in terms of what you recounted to people really being humiliated when they are traveling in terms of what airport security asks them to do. To individuals who are still facing, you know, employment discrimination, or are kids who are facing bullying at schools. We recently released a report that looks at the impact of profiling in New York City, specifically in Brooklyn and Queens, on South Asians 10 years after 9/11. And what we found with our community partners who worked on this report with us is that, you know, this sort of profiling continues to this day, whether it's in the airport arena, whether it's in with local law enforcement. You've probably seen a lot of the reports about the New York Police Department and their enforcement and surveillance of South Asian communities in New York City. And so What this leaves our community members with is this sense of, I don't fit in, there's something wrong with me, I am being sort of seen as someone who's different or suspect or disloyal. So decisions that many people take for granted, like what they wear when they travel or joining their students' religious association, has a lot more significance when it comes to people of South Asian, Arab, Muslim, or Sikh background, because their decisions could actually end up leading to profiling or leading to some sort of investigation. And so we're finding that that sort of climate does continue to exist 10 years later, and it's fueled by, you know, sometimes a lot of external events. It's fueled by the national security initiatives that our country is enforcing right now that has an impact on our communities. It's fueled by things like Park 51 and that controversy, rhetoric that policymakers use when they talk about our communities. So it really, unfortunately, has led to a continuing climate where people feel that they're still being targeted in some way, even though it's been 10 years since 9/11.
Yeah, it's interesting. So you actually, and I'd like you to say a little bit more about the article you wrote. I think in 2010, you were in the New York Times with an article that explored this exact thing that you're talking about. I believe, you're going to correct me, I think, but it's called When Will It End? Is that right?
Yeah, it was about scapegoating, and it was published in December of 2011, so quite recently. But it was basically an article that looks at this trend of what we call xenophobic rhetoric in political discourse. And we've been tracking it since 9/11, and we have a report out on it that folks can find at www.saalt.org. And what we basically are looking at is, when it comes to political discourse, how people who are elected to office or running for office are talking about our communities. What are they saying about South Asians, Muslims, Sikhs, Hindus, you know, our community generally? What kinds of policies are they vouching for when it comes to our communities? And sadly, what we found when we did this report was that there has been this unprecedented increase in the types of really negative racist rhetoric that is coming out of policymakers on both sides of the aisle when it comes to our communities. And that reflects sort of the mood in the country. So when you have policymakers saying things, you know, for example, well, I would never hire a Muslim for my cabinet, or, you know, I think that people who have who are wearing turbans should be pulled aside, or we don't need any turban toppers in Congress, and that's referring to someone who was running for Congress and who happened to be South Asian. When you hear, you know, when the general public hears comments like that from elected officials or people who are seen as having credibility, then it just fosters an environment where it seems okay to kind of espouse those same views. So the New York Times piece actually explores that in the context of more recent political discourse that we've been monitoring. And after the elections are over this year, we're going to come out with sort of a special brief, a special issue brief that traces what happened in the 2012 elections and the run-up to the elections. But sadly, that level of political discourse is quite lacking in our country right now, and we think it's important that everybody really hold our elected officials to task to make sure that they are not ending up, you know, casting these wide nets of suspicion or stereotyping about our communities or any community.
Now, Deepa, I'm a big fan of getting my news through podcasts, and I do that basically for my convenience, and have come across in more than one circumstance Representative King, who I believe is a Congress member out of New York, who recently undercame a lot of criticism, and I think he was, I don't know if he was involved in it or an active spokesperson defending it, but monitoring of student groups in Northeast colleges, maybe Rutgers. I don't have all the details, but I know there was something that happened recently. And you know, in hearing some of the follow-on articles and conversations, I did listen to Representative King and his point. Let me state it. I don't think I'll say it exactly like he would, but I want you to help the listeners understand how you would kind of reframe where he's headed and maybe challenge it. He's saying that there are people in certain communities, and I think he explicitly or implicitly means Muslim communities, who have ill intent, right? They're here for the wrong reasons. They're here to basically, you know, exert violence, and sleeper cells and a lot of the rhetoric that comes from that is something that he invokes. And he says in a very plain way, we need to actually be gathering intelligence and identifying these people before we identify them because they've committed an act. How would you counter that kind of perspective? It sounds, candidly, on a superficial level, it sounds rational. At the same time, a lot of people are collateral damage in such endeavors. So how do you sort of strike a perspective that is balanced based on things like what Congressman King says?
Well, you know, Congressman King actually has a pattern of talking about radicalization, or what he calls radicalization in the Muslim community. And he held hearings in Congress last March 2011. And basically his intent with those hearings was to supposedly explore the extent of Muslim radicalization. But instead what the hearings really became were really this very curious show and parade, because he didn't really make that point with the witnesses that he called up or the information that he provided. And instead he cast, again, very broad statements about, you know, mosques in this country and Muslims generally in this country, and invoking the fear that I think a lot of people have in our country, that what if something is going on at our local mosque? You know, that sort of fear rhetoric, fear mongering is what Representative King unfortunately has resorted to, instead of really looking at what are some facts and realities. And, you know, for example, the fact that if law enforcement creates trust and partnerships with communities, that there is a likelihood that if there is anything untoward happening, that communities will feel comfortable reporting it to law enforcement. And in fact, several of the terrorist threats that have occurred in this country over the past number of years have been investigated based on tips from the Muslim community. And instead of kind of looking at examples like that and talking about building trust between Muslim communities and other communities, or Muslim communities and law enforcement, Representative King unfortunately focuses in on casting these wide aspersions and these really broad generalizations about the community, and doesn't offer ways to actually address the threat of terrorism. And so, you know, we kind of have been, when he makes kind of some of these comments, you know, for us, it's really about looking at, well, what's actually happening on the ground and what are some solid, you know, law enforcement and community partnership tactics and methods that have worked and would work, instead of really demonizing this community and isolating the community and pushing them aside. We're more interested in seeing how there can be honest conversations and dialogues, rather than setting aside a community entirely just because of concerns that some folks might be engaging in terrorist activity.
Deepa, let me ask this. So you mentioned the social justice framework that, and that, by the way, that term, I'm sure you have not failed to notice, that term has been in the larger political dialogue in recent years as a point of contention that those who use it are of a certain political stripe and are not to be trusted. It's somewhat inconceivable. But let me ask this, in the framework of social justice that SALT works in and takes as its approach to addressing these issues, where are the glimmers of hope? This has been a conversation in which we've dealt with some pretty heady subjects, pretty tough ones, candidly. Where do you see some green shoots? Where do you see some signs of positive hope? And where do we need to go in the future?
Well, I think that when it comes to some of the issues that we work on, I think that what is really hopeful is the fact that you have more communities who are immigrant communities or communities of color that are starting to engage when it comes to the political process and getting very involved in it in different ways, whether it is to raise their voices on different issues and take action, or, you know, to all the way to running for office at local, state, and federal levels. And I think that there's something very exciting about the fact that we're seeing immigrants and people of color really engaging with the civic and political process in our country, because that is, for SALT, you know, that's one of our key goals, is to get our community to feel that we do deserve a place at the table and that we should be engaging in the civic process in this country, you know, whether it's running for office, whether it's voting, whether it's contacting your legislator, whether it's raising your voice in an opinion editorial, whatever it is, that it's really important for folks to feel empowered enough that they lend their voices. And so I think that that is one glimmer of hope that we've seen. And then I would also say that I think that with the coalitions that we're seeing that are forming between different communities, that also is a glimmer of hope. I know for us at SALT, we have really relied on some of the partnerships that we've built in the African American, Latino, progressive white community, LGBT community, and those have really been very important for us in terms of the frame of social justice that you mentioned, that really, you know, all of these issues are interconnected and all of our movements are interconnected. And we need to join together to kind of find that common cause in order to really create a brighter future for our children. And so I think that those two pieces are ones that, at least from our vantage point, we see a lot of hope in when it comes to the future.
Well, Deepa Iyer of South Asian Americans Leading Together, SALT, thanks so much for taking part in this Midler's podcast. It's been absolutely fascinating to hear your personal account of coming from India to the U.S., as well as your good work you're doing on behalf of all Americans through SALT. Thanks so much for coming today.
Thanks so much for having me.